ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 6, Text 3, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
Sonu Pravishto Bhagavan
Cheshta
Rupena Tanganam
Bhinnam
Sanyo Jayamasa Suptam karma prabodhayan.
Translation. Thus, when the personality of Godhead entered into the elements by his energy, all the living entities were enlivened into different activities, just as one is engaged in his work after awakening from sleep. Purport. Every individual soul remains unconscious after the dissolution of the creation and thus enters into the Lord with his material energy. These individual living entities are conditioned souls everlastingly, but in each and every material creation they are given a chance to liberate themselves and become free souls. They are all given a chance to take advantage of the Vedic wisdom and find out what is their relationship with the Supreme Lord, how they can be liberated, and what the ultimate profit is in such liberation. By properly studying the Vedas, one becomes conscious of his position and thus takes to the transcendental devotional service of the Lord and is gradually promoted to the spiritual sky. The individual souls in the material world engage in different activities according to their past unfinished desires. After the dissolution of a particular body, the individual soul forgets everything, but the all-merciful Lord, who is situated in everyone's heart as the witness, the supersoul, awakens him and reminds him of his past desires, and thus he begins to act accordingly in his next life. This unseen guidance is described as fate, and a sensible man can understand that this continues his material bondage in the three modes of nature. The unconscious sleeping stage of the living entity just after the partial or total dissolution of the creation is wrongly accepted as the final stage of life by some less intelligent philosophers. After the dissolution of the partial material body, a living entity remains unconscious for only a few months, and after the total dissolution of the material creation, he remains unconscious for many millions of years. But when the creation is again revived, he is awakened to his work by the Lord. The living entity is eternal, and the wakeful state of his consciousness manifested by activities is his natural condition of life. He cannot stop acting while awake, and thus he acts according to his diverse desires. When his desires are trained in the transcendental service of the Lord, his life becomes perfect, and he is promoted to the spiritual sky to enjoy eternal awakened life. These topics are a little difficult to understand. They're quite technical. As with any other technical subjects, unless one has much training in them, it's difficult to understand. Just like if, presuming none of us are nuclear physics or engineers for atomic power stations, if we were to read some literature, some book about the processes for establishing and maintaining nuclear power stations, or if we were to hear a discussion between the engineers who are involved in that, we probably wouldn't understand anything about it, because they have a specific technical language that they use, which is required. And there are various concepts which, without training, it doesn't mean anything. We might as well be speaking in a language that we don't understand at all. We have no entrance into that. So similarly, this is technical. Last night we were discussing at the Gaur Nithai temple, we were discussing about the nectar of devotion. Srila Prabhupada subtitled the Nectar of Devotion, which is the title of the book, The Nectar of Devotion, is a partial translation of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, of which The Nectar of Devotion is, as Srila Prabhupada calls it, a summary study. So Srila Prabhupada subtitled The Nectar of Devotion, The Complete Science of Bhakti Yoga. And actually, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, although it deals with Bhakti Ras, as is apparent from the title of the book, Bhakti Ras and all the different, what gives rise to rasa, the nature of different experiences, there's the levels of sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, prema bhakti, and then there are the bhav, anubhav, sanchari bhav. It's all very technical analysis of rasa and its components. So that's also a very technical book, which without studying deeply, it's difficult to understand. So here, similarly, is described, this chapter is titled, The Creation of the Universal Form. And here it's, in this particular verse, the technical description of how the personality of Godhead entered into the elements by his energy. So this means that, of course, he's always present within the elements, but he it's a shakti sanchar. It's easier to say it in the original Sanskrit terms. Shakti sanchar. He enlivened it with his energy. He imbued it with his energy. And when he did that, all the living entities were enlivened into different activities. So this is creation means, creation gives the sense that there was nothing prior to that. In the Christian tradition, the general understanding is that God created the world, it's called ex nihilo. It means out of nothing. There was nothing and then God created the world. Of course, we're not here to denigrate the Christian or any other tradition, but they don't actually have science. In their scriptures, there's no scientific knowledge of this sambandha abhidheya prayoja. In this purport, Srila Prabhupada has alluded to sambandha. They're all given Vedic wisdom. Find out what is their relationship with the Supreme Lord. That's sambandha gyan. How they can be liberated. The process, that's abhidheya. And what the ultimate profit is in such liberation, so prayoja. So they don't have scientific knowledge. They or detailed knowledge. Simply they say God created the world in how many days? Anyone know? 6 days. And then on the seventh day he rested. So that's called the Sabbath. And in the Jewish tradition, Sabbath is on the Saturday. And in the Christian tradition, it's on Sunday. So according to the Jews, God rested on a Saturday. And according to the Christians, on a Sunday. But it's not very detailed. They don't give any details of how this is done. Whereas in the Bhagavatam and in other Vedic literatures, there are descriptions of how, what is this creation? You see, they have the idea, in the Western world, there is the notion of linear time. That today it is May the 1st, 2008. And yesterday was April the 30th, 2008. And tomorrow, should we see it, is May the 2nd, 2008. And so
You just go back day by day by day, and you can talk about some date,
January the 2nd, 3012 BC. Of course, they didn't have January in those days, but you could think, of December the 29th in the year 5042 AD. So we have an idea that time has come, it's come day by day and it goes forward. And there's the idea that, well, there was a beginning and there'll be an end, and then that's it, it's finished. God created the world, and then He created all the living beings, and then there'll come a time when it's all destroyed, and some will go to heaven, and most of them, according to the Christian or Abrahamic traditions, they'll all go to hell. And that's it, then it's all over. But the Vedic tradition speaks of what we can call a circular time. That, you see, even if you say that God, He created the world, and then after a long time he destroys it again, and then everyone either goes to heaven or they go to hell. But however long it is, it's just a blip in time. In eternity, it's nothing. And then there rises the question, well, why did He create souls? And then why does, in most of them, most of them are supposed to be going to hell, according to what they say. Oh, something is important. More important than hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, it seems. So, it seems like a very strange thing, like God had some kind of whim or something, and He created a whole bunch of souls, and few of them He sent to heaven, and the rest of them He sent to hell, and that's just like a little game He plays, and then it's all over. Whereas the Vedic tradition speaks of that the souls are eternally existing. When we speak of creation, it's creation of the material world, but that creation is followed by destruction, and then again creation. It goes on and on. It's not that even if one is completely sinful, then he gets chance after chance after chance, not that he's sent to hell forever and ever and ever. So there's this technical description is there, and we may think, well, you know, it's pretty tough. Well, it is pretty tough, but it's also required. The principles behind it are required to be understood. This is sambandha gyan, how the living beings in this material world have no actual relationship with it, but we are placed in this material existence due to our karma dosh, due to our own fault, of our own misuse of our independence. This is a the lack of knowledge in so-called theistic tradition leads to philosophical problems. Because if we accept that God is all good, and there's no meaning to be Him being God if He's not all good, and if we accept that He's all powerful, and there's no meaning to Him being God if He's not all powerful, then why do good people suffer in the world? That's a big problem for the people who think that the soul is just created. When you're born, you're created, a new soul. And then when you die, there are different theories. Generally it's said if you're good, you go to heaven, and if you're bad, you go to hell. So then, if God is all powerful and He's all good, then why is it that the bad people tend to rule the world? And so many good people, they suffer so much. So it becomes a theological problem. And some of them say, well, God is all good, but He's not really in control. He's kind of lost control. But that's another kind of atheism.
He's a good guy. He likes you. He wishes you well. But, you know, he's not really on top of things. That's one theory. And you can still pray to him and he can try and help you, but, you know, he's pretty busy. He's got a lot of people trying to phone him up, and, you know, he can't deal with them all at once. Maybe he created too many souls and it got out of hand or something. So it's due to lack of knowledge they have so many philosophical misunderstandings. But here the understanding is given that it may be that someone acts well in this life, but due to previous lives' activities, he's suffering. And often, the people who get in power, that may be due to some pious activity performed in a previous life. But then they get some position, and then they misuse it. As it said, power corrupts. So when they may have acted piously, but because they are not actually God conscious, then when they get some position, they misuse it, and then they go to hell. So like that, the samsara chakra or the kala chakra is like that. Sometimes someone acts piously, then he gets some facility for enjoying this material world, and then he misuses it, and then he suffers, and then he thinks, oh, I'm suffering, I should be good, and then maybe in a future life I'll get some good opportunity. So then again he becomes good. So like this it goes on. He's good, and then bad, and then good, and then bad. So what is called good in this world, it's often not really, it's not good in the ultimate sense, but rather it's just people acting in what they consider as a good way so that they can get an opportunity to enjoy themselves better in future. And practically most of the religion in the world goes on under this principle. People think, let me pray to God, and then he will bless you, and then you can live comfortably in this world, or at least you can go to heaven and live comfortably there. You can enjoy yourself there. The idea is how I will enjoy myself with God's blessings. It's better than the idea I will enjoy myself, full stop. It's definitely better. But it's a long way from anyabhilashita shunyam gyanakama dhyanavritama anukulena krishnanushilanam bhaktiruttama, from pure devotional service in which there's no personal desire, only the desire to satisfy Krishna. Now there are other religious strands in which people think that, well, this material world is miserable, so let's try and get out of it, mukti. So we'll find, like for instance, in most of Christianity or Islam, it not exactly parallels, but it's similar to the karma kanda idea in the Vedas, that you perform some pious work and God will bless you and you will enjoy in the future life. You can go to heaven. Behista, it's called in Islam, right? You know that? Behista means heaven. That you can enjoy yourselves. I know, because on the back of so many auto rickshaws in Dhaka, in Bangladesh, it's written, Namaz beheste chabi. Namaz is, you know what namaz is, right?
Yes, sir.
Namaz is the key to heaven. So they're encouraging people to do that. So they're very religious. But it's still personally motivated, because they say, I will be, by being religious, I will benefit, and I will be saved from hell, and I will, by the blessing of God, enjoy myself in future. I will get all facility from him for enjoyment. There are others who see, well, actually, there's nothing much to enjoy anyway. What is this enjoyment? This material world is, it's janma mrityu jara vyadhi, dukkhamai. It's simply full of suffering. And so they aspire for becoming detached from this world and thus attaining mukti. So we find in general Hinduism, people are interested that we will worship God or the gods or the snakes or the bhutas or the amma or something like this, and we will get their blessings for material enjoyment. And there are others who are like in the Shankara line, who they think Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya, this world is false, and Brahma, spiritual, that is the reality. So that's, they're more interested in Gyan, in cultivating knowledge of the difference between spirit and matter. And we find Buddhism is based on this. Similar idea. This world is miserable. Desire is the cause of misery. Therefore, we should stop all desires. Buddhism and Shankara philosophy, it's almost the same. Although Shankara, he opposed Buddhism. But in essence, it's the same. Prachanda bodham uchate. This, the Mayavad of Shankaracharya is said to be covered Buddhism. Although actually in Buddhism, because most people are not interested in liberation. Most people are interested in enjoying this world or enjoying themselves in a future life. So therefore you'll find that in Buddhism, many people worship Buddha with the idea he will bless you for material enjoyment. Or they have the idea, it's not what Buddha taught, or they have the idea that Buddha will take you to a promised land where you can enjoy yourself. Or they pay nominal lip service to Buddha and they worship ghosts. That's very common, just like, for instance, in Thailand. All of China, they worship their deceased forefathers. Basically, it's ghost worship. In Thailand, the official religion is Buddhism. But the actual religion which people practice every day is worshipping spirits. It's a low form of religion, local spirits, the spirit of the house. If something goes wrong in the house, you think the spirit of the house is not satisfied. You have to give them tea and coffee, you have to give them like that, some cigarettes and food every day, like this. You have to offer them food and all different things. Then the spirit will be happy. That's the idea. You have to offer them some incense. So the idea of bhakti, the concept of bhakti, that's very much misunderstood. When we say bhakti, and what the average Hindu understands by bhakti is something different. Because they understand bhakti, that means you worship some different god and you're very devoted, but you get something from them. But Rupa Goswami's concept of bhakti is anyabhilashitashunya, without any personal desire. What Rupa Goswami has taught is actual bhakti without any personal motivation. That you simply love Bhagavan for the sake of love. Love is the reason. There's no other reason. And then you may say, well, all right, but why bhakti for Krishna? Why not on a different demigod? So why not for some film star? Love. It's all love. But that is established in Srimad Bhagavatam. That Krishna is the actual object of love. Premaspad is the... Sanskrit term. That by offering our love to anyone but Krishna, we will be frustrated. Actually, that cannot be love. Because love means for Krishna. If our love is not centered on Krishna, it's not actually love.
because only Krishna is the actual object of love. So we may say, well, I love my wife, and I love my dog, and I love my country, and I love my football team. But that's misplaced, because none of these can reciprocate as Krishna can. They are not the actual sources of love. So for us to direct our love at them, or for them to accept that love, is actually an expression of envy to Krishna. That we are denying that Krishna should be the object of love. And instead attempting to deflect our loving propensity elsewhere. So this scientific delineation, now you're showing your feet to Krishna. Please don't do that. So this scientific delineation of the process of bhakti. Not just the process, sambandha, abhideya, and prayojan. This scientific delineation of who is the Supreme, why are we here, what is our relationship with Him, how this material world is running on. That's all given in Srimad Bhagavatam, so that we can understand what is our position, what is our present what is our present conditioned status, and why we need to take up bhakti and become free from this conditioning and attain to our actually liberated state in service to Krishna, in pure devotion to Krishna. So this should be understood. Like I was saying, people generally think that bhakti is sentimentalism. That's what people generally think. And actually, that's what I see in many of our devotees. They have some sukriti or some pious attainment from, please don't show your feet to the deity. And it would be better, actually, you can do all this bowing down later. Now the class is going on. So it's a bit of a disturbance. Yeah, because people don't hear, they think, I have to do all these things. When Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was lecturing, the arati began, so many people left to see the arati. He said, they're going for eye exercises. He was criticizing them, meaning they can't actually see the deity. They think that's going to see, that we were just filling up time by listening, and now we're going to the arati, which is the really important thing. But he was saying, no, hearing is the important thing. You can't see without hearing. So people take up bhakti, and those who are piously disposed, they take to bhakti, and they think that, well, it's bhakti means feelings, which is true. But bhakti, the bhakti bhav, that is, the bhakti bhav develops after the stage of anartha nivritti. Of course, the feelings must be there even in the beginning of bhakti, but as long as we have contaminated material desires, or as long as we have the contamination of material desires, then our feelings are going to be mundane or mixed with mundaneness. So Srila Prabhupada presented the Srimad Bhagavatam as the science of understanding the personality of Godhead and our relationship with Him. It's bhakti bhav and prem bhakti. These are the goals, of course. But mere sentimentalism or emotionalism, that is not pure bhakti. The science of bhakti is to be understood, and we have to distinguish we have to distinguish between spirit and matter and follow the process of bhakti to become purified. Just like many people come to me as a sannyasi and ask for my blessings, which is all right, but we should understand that we have to do our work also. It's not just, you know, blessings, okay, and then all of a sudden, psh, there's some electric shock and you become full of Krishna prema. But actually, it's not necessary to all the time ask blessings, blessings, blessings. It's understood that if one is seriously following the process of bhakti, then why should one be deprived of those blessings? It's not. It's just like Srila Prabhupada criticized that the Christians, they pray, give us this day our daily bread. It's like, you know, you don't trust God. Does the child every day ask the mother, are you going to feed me today? Prabhupada gave this example. Why do you have to ask for bread? He's giving it to you. So if we're sincere in performing our devotional activities, then automatically the blessings will be there. And at the same time, we should understand that blessings are not a substitute for performing activities in bhakti. That we have to hear and chant about and serve Krishna. That is required. We have to study these books that Srila Prabhupada has given us, understand what is in them, and apply that in our lives. So, of course, bhakti means there's feelings, emotion, joy. There is the nectar of devotion. Last night we were discussing the nectar of devotion. But the nectar of devotion, that book begins with a philosophical analysis of the superiority of bhakti overall process, and then the methodology of practically applying bhakti in our lives. Otherwise, Rupa Goswami could have just said that, well, you just get blessings, full stop, one line, and finish everything. But he didn't say that. Or he gave a detailed analysis of the process of bhakti. So, we should try to understand the process of bhakti scientifically, as Srila Prabhupada always presented. This is the complete science of bhakti yoga. Actually, when we hear about the descriptions of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu dancing, all the devotees dancing with him, people in general, they tend to think of that as some kind of sentimentalism. What is sentimentalism? Sentimentalism means it's nothing, it's not very deep, but it's an emotional outburst, you could say, of people who are not, you know, they don't think very much. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his feelings for Krishna were profound, and his understanding of bhakti tattva. Tattva means the essence. His philosophical presentations were extremely deep. His understanding was profound. You know what this word profound means? It means the deep, deep, essential, like this. It means deep, essential, deep in terms of philosophical understanding or experience. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his dancing is not like that of some, you know, people go to a marriage party and they start dancing. There's some Bollywood music and they all start dancing. Often we see that we in India and other countries, we perform public sankirtan, we're dancing, and people come and join. They think, hey, this is fun, this is great. It's like a marriage party or something. Or we join in festivals, in some public festival in the West, and people are there to dance anyway, and they think, well, this is great, we can join this dancing too. So they benefit by this, but we should understand that the dancing of foolish materialists and sentimentalists and the dancing of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his followers, that's on a different platform. The dancing of sentimentalists takes place on the platform of sentiment, which is it's simply a mental transformation. Whereas the dancing of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that arises from his profound spiritual absorption. It's a different thing altogether. It's a different phenomenon altogether. So it's good to take to bhakti. That is for sure. And even if one takes to it in whichever way, that's good. But to remain on the sentimental platform of simply echoing some statements without understanding what they really mean, that will not help us very much. Just like people say, well, the mercy of the Vaishnavas is everything. Well, it's true. But we should try to understand how that's true by studying Srila Prabhupada's books. It's not just, you know, okay, mercy of the Vaishnava, you know, we just say it, but what is the characteristic of a Vaishnava? What is the characteristic of Vishnu? What is the relationship? All these things should be understood by studying the books of Krishna consciousness, just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself would daily hear Srimad Bhagavatam, and he discussed this philosophy inside out with. We'll get in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, the compilation of that, with Sarvabhaum Bhattacharya, with Prakashananda Saraswati, with Ramananda Rai, Sanatana Goswami, Rupa Goswami. These are the principal discussions which are recorded in Chaitanya Charitamrita and which are summarized in Srila Prabhupada's teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So, Srila Prabhupada never presented Krishna consciousness as a kind of Hindu religion, but rather as a scientific understanding that is applicable to every jiva. Now, for diplomatic or logistical purposes, we may in various circumstances present Krishna consciousness as a kind of Hinduism or something like that. Just like I see the signboard here as we enter, it says ISKCON, what is it, the Indian Cultural and Social Organization, something like that. So according to the circumstance, we may present it like that. But we should ourselves understand that Krishna consciousness has got nothing to do with India per se. Krishna consciousness transcends India. It's not that Krishna has been primarily worshipped in India is a historical fact, but that doesn't mean that Krishna is Indian or that Krishna, as according to the dictionary definition, is a Hindu god. And if we present Krishna consciousness, like I say, in certain circumstances we may do, but at the same time, we should inculcate among our own members and among newcomers that this is not for Hindus only, and nor is it that if someone from a non-Hindu background takes to this that they'll be converted to Hinduism. Rather, it is the science of the soul and the supreme soul and the relationship between them. One may identify himself as Hindu, Muslim, or Christian, or whatever, but the supreme is neither Hindu, nor Christian, nor Muslim. And those who are actually inquisitive to understand the truth, they should try to find this out. What is the nature of the truth? Is God a Hindu, a Christian, or a Muslim? Well, he's none of these things. He transcends all these things. So we should try to understand this. I'm going to finish now because, anyway, I could speak much more, but I'll speak later in any way. My voice is a little weak. Last Sunday, was it?
I think it was last, no, two Sundays ago. I gave a class in the morning, then a class at midday, and then I had a big program with 1,000 people in the evening, but I couldn't give it because my voice went out. So I'd better stop here, but I can take one or two questions if anyone wants. At midday we'll have the class in here, is it, in this hall? It's better because people are coming in and out all the time and it's just a disturbance. Huh? Yeah, it's just that, you know, people coming in and out and it's just a constant distraction. Better to have another hall, yeah. Have it in the other hall. Yeah. Then, is there any question?
Worship of the spirit soul.
Worship of the spirit soul?
Spirit is a spirit.
Ah. You see, in English there's a confusion. The word spirit can mean various. I was talking about worship of spirits. That means bhut puja is one. And that also means like gramya devata. And not just bhut, gramya devata, you know, like the spirit of the trees and the spirit, local village gods and the spirit of the river and the spirit of the mountain and like this. And you'll find in Hinduism, there's so many things, like Naga Puja and all this kind of thing. That's in among the Tulu people, that's very prominent, Naga Puja. In Bengal also, Manasa Devi, they worship. Ma Manasa, Vishahari, they worship snake gods, goddess. So that's a low level, you can say. When we say worship of spirits, that doesn't mean worship of Atma. It's a different use of the word spirit. The English is a bit confused there, because spirit means like bhut, preet, and also gramya devata, and it also means Atma. So it's a bit confusing. And a worship of Atma, worship of oneself, that's also the ahangraho pasana, that when you worship yourself, that's a different process altogether. That's what the Maya, some kind of impersonalists, they do that. Was that what you were asking about?
Yeah, the Lord also says in Bhagavad
Gita
that in that, is when it's the forefathers, it's not referring to the spirit soul itself.
The Pitri referring to the spirit soul, but Pitri, and you know, spirit soul means Atma, Jivatma. So worship of the Pitris is not worth. They are Jivatmas, but what's
in another word, the question is when the Jivatma becomes, how it becomes worshipable?
How does the Jiva become worshipable? Well, that's due to ignorance. People worship different demigods out of ignorance, so they worship the Pitris out of ignorance, so their worship should be directed toward Krishna. They're not actually worshipable. That's what I was saying, that the actual object of love or the actual object of worship is Krishna. And one way worship jivas in a bona fide way, as if they're being worshipped as devotees of Krishna. So we worship the Guru as a representation of Krishna, not separately. Only because he's presenting Krishna. Not for any other reason. We offer respect to demigods because they're empowered representatives of the Supreme Lord, of Krishna. But to worship a jiva without understanding their relationship with Krishna, that is avidhi purvakam. It's not proper. You're all the time putting your hand on your mouth, then you're going to put on the Srimad Bhagavatam, the beads and everything. So you should actually wash your hand, according to Srila Prabhupada. I personally saw this. Hand on the mouth means get out, wash your hand. That's what Prabhupada said. Otherwise, you see, you'll put on the door, then someone else will touch it. Everything becomes contaminated. Yeah, you were going to ask a question.
You see, I can't have a question. That in our day-to-day life, we have obstacles facing us.
Yeah.
You know, we depend on Krishna. We need Krishna to give us strength to go through these hurdles in our life.
To pray to Krishna to overcome the hurdles in it. To tolerate. We can pray to Krishna for the strength to tolerate the various obstacles. We can pray, for instance, that, my boss is, doesn't let me keep a picture of Krishna in the office. So we may pray to Krishna that his mind may change. We wouldn't pray to Krishna that may he die. You may pray to Krishna that he may become more favorable toward bhakti. You can pray like that. Yeah.
Would it be wrong to pray to you?
Just one more thing, if you don't mind. I was just going to say one more thing about that. As far as sickness is concerned, from what I can see, the general prescription, not doctor's prescription, but shastric prescription, is to tolerate it. Of course, one may go to a doctor and this and that, but generally one doesn't pray to Krishna for removing that. Just one tolerates. Tatenu kampam susamikshamano, thinking, it's my previous karma. One may pray that, Krishna, if you remove this, then I can serve you better. But then you may consider also, Krishna's put me in this position, or I've got this position due to my previous activities, and I have to serve Krishna in this situation. What were you going to say?
Why God created the universe and created so many souls?
You weren't here at the beginning of the class. I discussed... I discussed this in the beginning of the class. So, if you would have come, you would have heard it. Why do people come late to class? I can do, but... again, the question comes, why come late to class? If you want to know, you could come on time. It was discussed, practically the whole first half of the class was discussing this question. If you want, you can get a recording and hear it. There are so many recordings here. The essence of it is that it's our own misuse of our independence. Yeah, we should give a one dinar fine every time it goes off. We'd find if we did that people would be more conscious to turn their phones off, right? I suggest you can institute that. Because, it's another disturbance. It's our own misuse of our independence to serve Krishna or not serve Krishna. It's up to us. It's not as in the Christian idea that God created souls and then threw most of them into hell. It's misuse of our own. The little independence God has given us has been misused by ourselves. Okay, one dinar. It's our fault. It's not God's whimsy. All right, I'll finish now, and then again later we can discuss. Hare Krishna. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Just one second. Srila Prabhupada told me to write educational and philosophical books, so in pursuance of that order, I have written some, and some are available here. Not many. Is this all the varieties we have? That's it. All right. Some are available here in various languages. So if you'd like to take some, and you will be benefited,
and you will encourage me in my service to Srila Prabhupada. So please take some. There are also some CDs of lectures available, which people can take. The CDs are available, I don't know, in English, Bengali, and maybe some in Hindi also. So if you like to take, please take. And Hare Krishna, see you all, I hope, a little later at 11 o'clock also. Hare Krishna. Careful, careful. I'll get down this way. Hare Krishna.
Lord Brahma lives for 100 years. Well, that's his 100 years is the duration of the, it's not our 100 years, it's the duration of the whole universe. Then the whole when Lord Brahma dies, the whole universe is wrapped up. And everything enters into Mahavishnu.
And Lord Shiva?
Lord Shiva, he's always there. See, the material world is destroyed, not everything is destroyed. So his abode continues to exist. It's on the... it's not inside Vaikuntha, but it's not inside the material world. See, Shiva Tattva, it's quite complex. He has manifestations within this world, but he continues to exist.
Lord Shiva is always there, he never dies.
Sadashiva is the original form of Lord Shiva, which is actually Vishnu, from which Shiva is manifested. We need to do some more research on this. Shiva Tattva is quite honest. Shiva Goswami says, Shiva Tattva is Guru Tattva.